Sustainability is a holistic process, needs to be integrated into buildings from the early stage, and that depends on an integrated design team for the earliest stages. As technologists, I firmly believe that should be what we are doing.
Welcome to Where It's At, the podcast from CIET, shining a spotlight on the future-focused design discipline of architectural technology. Know someone who could benefit from listening? Subscribe and share this episode with your network.
I'm Chris Halligan, Chartered Architectural Technologist, Chartered Environmentalist, and I'm currently Chair of CIET's Climate Society. I've led teams from inception to completion across a variety of projects across numerous sectors, including residential, educational, commercial, leisure, institutional, across a career spanning over 30 years, as well as dealing with the technical and functional resolution of buildings. I also specialise in sustainable design. My interest in sustainability and the performance of building materials, especially in relation to the envelope and the environment, probably even predates my involvement with architecture. And over that time, attempted to instigate various forms of design to create low impact projects, and eventually come to the conclusion that most of our efforts aren't doing the job that's required, not because of any technical knowledge, but because of the way things really are run and acquired and the way we go about things. And I hope we're going to sort of demonstrate that to you today. My guest co-host is Alex Tilley, who's senior building consultant at Nolo Carbo and a building physicist who I've worked with a couple of times. Hello, Alex.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alex Tilley. As Chris mentioned, I'm a senior building performance consultant at Nolo Carbo. I'm an accredited domestic and non-domestic energy assessor, and I am a technologist under the Chartered Institute of Building Services Engineering. As Chris said, I fall into the area of construction that he likes to specialise in, the sustainability, the building envelope, the low impact building, and through the use of dynamic thermal modelling software, myself and my company Nolo Carbo look to support in building design in order to optimise the outcomes of a building, whether that be operational energy, operational cost, EPC rating, or just holistic sustainability, which I think Chris and I both agree is the best route.
What this podcast's about, it really is about one particular project and how Alex and I worked together on it. And this was a project in the Holbeck area of Leeds. It was a mixed-use development. It was a single building. It was primarily a sports training hub, changing rooms for outdoor football pitches, a gymnasium. It had as well a pharmacy in there and also a general practitioner surgery, a doctor's, over two floors. It was really just a long rectangular box with a heavily glazed frontage facing south. Now, I inherited this. I wasn't involved with the initial design of it. I was given it at roughly RIBA stage two, verging three. The building was designed but not fully coordinated. Now, like a lot of schemes that we technologists seem to be given, it had been designed before our involvement, and I was asked to resolve that design and look at what we could do with it. And it became apparent that a lot of sustainable principles hadn't been considered at the first stage, and it just assumed that any low or zero carbon requirement would be dealt with by bolt-on systems at a later stage. Now, that is completely against what I feel the technology should be doing and how buildings should operate. I believe that buildings should themselves be environmental modifiers through the envelope. But it's the kind of thing you have to consider right from the outset. So too often, the basic design ignores environmental performance of the envelope and the fabric for a number of reasons, being just put on the too hard shelf, or a lack of a client brief or buy-in, or in the D&B sphere, contractor-led decisions based on capital expenditure rather than operational costs because they have no long-term interest in the building itself, and energy is still relatively cheap. So we had the singular advantage that we were working for the eventual occupier rather than the contractor. You want to comment on that, Alex?
Yeah, it was my second project working with you, Chris, wasn't it? Having a been involved in a previous project also at Leeds in the leisure sector. And I think we realised fairly quickly on, just through design team meetings and contacts to each other, that we're on a similar level when it comes to banging the drum of sustainability. I appreciated working with you as a technologist due to your drive to improve a building and not just do the bare minimum. And it gave me a bit more agency and a bit more ability to be creative in what I do. And I think, as we've shown previously, and as we go on to show in this project, a strong combination of technologists and building physicists can really lead to a truly sustainable building design.
Yeah, as Alex said, we worked together previously on projects where he was actually engaged to support contractor-led decisions. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, that's really almost a box-ticking exercise to get through building regulations. And despite the fact that building regulations should be considered a minimum standard, they often become the de facto target for people just trying to spend as little as possible. We wanted to do things different on this one, and we had an opportunity because we persuaded the client to appoint Alex, the company that he's with, to really work with ourselves. We saw it as an opportunity to introduce low energy, a low energy concept as a guiding principle. Feel very strongly that early engagement of an integrated design team is an essential part of sustainable design, although, frankly, on this scheme, it still wasn't early enough. It had been largely resolved. But when I started to look at it and start looking at sections and examining it, I realised that at least part of the building could benefit from the introduction of passive principles, but it would need proving in detail to persuade the client of both the environmental and economic benefits. So I discussed the scheme and shared my thoughts with Alex by the way of sketches using those red and blue arrows that we like to cover drawings with when we're talking about sustainable performance. And we started looking at concepts to introduce natural ventilation, exploiting thermal mass for night cooling, and improve daylighting. And in fact, we started with the issue of daylighting. Alex provided a daylighting study, which indicated there may be a problem with excessive glare close to those large areas of glazing on the south, as well as dark areas elsewhere, often within the same space. The first and fairly straightforward solution was to introduce sun pipes to improve at least the upper floor daylight. We also studied how these might be used to transmit light to the lower floors via risers. But when it came to balancing the excessive glare at the edge of the deeper spaces, I introduced Alex to the concept of the light shelf. There's a very useful, if somewhat dated, document from the Building Research Establishment called the Environmental Design Guide for Naturally Ventilated and Daylit Offices. And although we weren't really dealing with offices, it provided a basic guide to many aspects of passive design and has rule of thumb principles for the design of light shelves. Now, light shelves can help with solar shading, but primarily redirect sunlight more evenly into deep plant spaces. So when Alex and I worked together trying various arrangements, dimensions and heights of a shelf until we arrived at a design which resolved the issues of excessive glare and solar gain. And Alex's modelling resulted in a report illustrating this. Alex?
That's right. I think one thing to stress here is that in a traditional building physics zero carbon roadmap, the old saying goes, if you get the daylight right, everything else will be right. Natural daylight, you all want it in your building. No one wants to be spending their days in a dark, artificially lit room. And what's also important in the UK, where we have strong kind of like sunlight in the summer, but also in the shoulder seasons of autumn and spring, is to ensure that you're not getting so much daylight that you're having a space overheating outside of summer. Now, what we found, this is where the dynamic thermal modelling became important, because it was able to point us to issues that maybe wouldn't have been considered previous to the thermal modelling getting involved, is that south facade was really overlit. So that at the second floor, there was a slight overhang on the roof of the building, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And I think that the previous designers had decided that would be sufficient to provide overshading. But the reality is, for most of the year in the UK, the sun doesn't sit right at the top of the sky. And if you've got a south-facing facade that's 100% glazed, you're going to have a lot of issues there. So what we found was that the first 3 or 4 metres from the facade was completely overlit. It was well over 3,000 lux, which is normally considered the most that you want in terms of natural daylight in a space. And importantly, what that also indicated is that there could be some overheating issues in there. Now, some of those rooms on that facade, we were looking to not put artificial cooling into, because it's, again, it's another energy consumption. So if we felt like if we could get that balance of daylight, we would be able to enable a passive cooling solution further down the line.
It was a really interesting way of working, actually, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to share it with everybody else, that as a team, I had knowledge of certain technical devices, such as light shells, but Alex understood the actual physics to put it together. And sort of working together, we learned off each other and came to a reasonable conclusion.
It was great, Chris, that you could send me an email one day and kind of be like, Alex, I've had this idea. I've done a sketch. In my head, this works in concept. This works based on my previous years of experience in the industry. But can you give me some evidence? Can you give me some data so I can go to our client and occupant and actually say to them, I don't think this is going to work. I know it's going to work.
Yeah.
And through that, we were able to go through this iterative process, even with something as simple as the depth of the light shelf. We were able to work out the optimal kind of dimensions of the light shelf on that south-facing curtain wall facade, and then go back to the client in a presentation further down the line and say to them, this is exactly what we need to do. This isn't just rules of thumb. This is specific to your building, exactly in your location, with exactly your dimensions.
This is true. So the daylighting was just part of it. That was just the start of it. And then we started looking at how to possibly naturally ventilate and cool the building, at least part of it. So we discussed the idea of introducing thermal mass and natural ventilation. And we were both familiar with the base concept, but Alex proved that the base concept that would work, but there wouldn't be enough thermal mass in the current design to form adequately. He had quite a lightweight roof, quite a nice curved aluminium roof with nothing underneath it. Now, for those of you that are familiar or not familiar with thermal mass, if you have a thermally heavyweight material such as concrete, over the day, it will absorb heat, and then 8 hours later, it will re-emit it. If you can vent that heat at night, use night cooling in a temperate climate, at least, it can help to temper and even out the internal temperatures in a building. As we didn't have enough concrete, I suggest the use of phase change materials. Now, phase change materials are something that I've followed since they first appeared a few decades ago. And there are particular variety of material, usually based on a form of oil, formed into boards, which can act in the same way as a thermally heavy material, such as concrete, but looks more like plasterboard. So I introduced a particular board product to Alex, and after acquiring the necessary technical data, he modelled the introduction of this at ceiling level in the spaces we were looking at.
Yeah, so this was my first time properly modelling phase change materials within the software that we use, which is ISVE, which is a virtual environment where you can do a whole kind of host of things to do with building simulation and modeling. And as it goes, IES has now released an update to incorporate these types of phase change materials. So it's clear that Chris and I were riding on a wave of phase change material that is very rapidly growing and swelling, just down to the benefits that it can provide when it comes to a natural ventilation strategy, especially if you're looking for a lightweight structure or if you're not able to get concrete on site. But unfortunately, that wasn't available when we did this a year or so ago. So instead, I had to prorate the equivalent thermal mass that we were looking at within IES using a typical heavyweight construction such as concrete. I then took that kilojoule per Kelvin figure and worked out the equivalent meter squared of this phase change material that would be required to put it up on the ceiling, basically.
Know someone with a story to tell or a topic to explore? Email atpodcast@ciat.global to nominate a guest or a topic.
Yeah, and we did look at, discussed at one point putting it on the walls, didn't we, to increase the area. But that was interesting with Alex providing me with a criteria to work to in terms of square meterage. And then I looked at how we could incorporate it architecturally. We introduced the PCM board as ceilings. But in order to allow the warm air to rise and be extracted as part of the cooling process at roof level, these ceilings couldn't be wall to wall. So we ended up with a series of rafts, which also would have provided acoustic baffling in otherwise quite tall spaces. They also provide mounties for light fittings, as well as the phase change materials. We'll allow that rising air to rise past them, that warm air to rise past them and be vented out. We tried a few different layouts. It was, again, a trial and error operation. I'd sketch a few. Alex would model it and tell me what he thought. And we kicked suggestions back and forth. It was a great team experience. Now, a similar two-way operation applied to the areas of glazing, solar shading and vent louvers, as Alex suggested. I would throw suggestions and he would advise on the impact in the overall environmental performance. And although we're talking to you here about these separate subjects, it's important to realise that we were dealing with the environmental design as a whole. It was a holistic process. You can't separate just one thing out from the rest. So Alex was instrumental in forming the design constraints for the detailed design to achieve what we intended, and eventually arrived at an optimum solution. We came up with some basic design parameters, providing ventilation at the external wall, airflow through the spaces, incorporating phase change materials, ceilings, and exited at high level via internal wall and then ceiling vents. And the internal wall vents would have to be acoustic rated as well, because some were in meeting rooms. So it was quite a convoluted process, but in the end, I think we came up with something that worked.
Yeah, we definitely did. And this is where I'd like the listener to visualise one of those blue and red arrow diagrams that you drew, Chris. And imagine that we have our building in section. We're looking at the first floor. And I mean, like a lot of commercial buildings, it's not narrow enough in depth to have two-sided ventilation within one room. That's just the financial reality of buildings. It's very difficult to make a very long, thin building. Thus, we were looking at one-sided ventilation, which does reduce the scope of natural ventilation because you can't quite get far enough into the room with one-sided ventilation. So therefore, we started to consider, how about we pull some air through, as Chris said, internal louvers above the corridor inside of the rooms, and then up through some turrets or wind catchers on the roof. And then we also realised that was, again, still wasn't quite enough with regards to providing sufficient free cooling through natural ventilation. Myself and my company ran it against the typical TM52 thermal comfort requirements, and there was just a little bit more needed. So what we ended up doing is putting in some louvers on the external facade at a low level, which were actuated. Thus, we had high and low openings on the external facade and then an opening on the internal side through to a roof turret wind catcher. This enabled us to get a really good amount of flow through the room, and importantly, with the actuated louvers, enabled us to use a bit of night purge. So as Chris said, thermal mass is great. 8 hours later, you get a lot of heat being released, but you need to make sure that heat can go somewhere. That means you either need to have a window open or a ventilation unit running overnight. Ventilation units, more energy, so if possible, you'd ideally just have a window, or for security reasons, an actuated louver open overnight. And for a series of iterations, we were able to work out the optimal dimensions for this louver, weren't we, Chris?
Yeah. As we go forward through this, you'll see that the decisions we were making and the solutions we're coming up with were having to be introduced into a really an already designed envelope. Now, please try and imagine how much easier this would have been if the original designer had sat down and thought, okay, I've got this facade. How am I going to bring air in here? When we come up with the idea of louvers, part of my job was to incorporate it aesthetically rather than just banging vents on the outside of a wall and hoping it'll work. We actually incorporated it in the curtain walling and had a strip going around the building. It became a design feature. That's what doesn't tend to happen, is that if you're dealing with a bolt-on type solution, we were incorporating these solutions within the fundamental design of the building. But we could only go so far with it because it had already been designed largely in terms of mass. So anyway, Alex prepared a first report, taking into account all these suggested principles, came up with illustrations of both the financial and environmental impacts for various degrees and combinations of implementation, going from your bog standard with the gas boilers through to fully all singing, all dancing, and actually into looking what would happen if we introduce additional technologies such as photovoltaic cells. As I say, we came up with a sliding scale of options, and it was incredibly well received.
Yeah, I think that there was a balance to be struck with the reporting, in that we had the occupant sat in the meeting that we were presenting to. We had the, I guess, the funder, the person who is more bothered about the capital costs. And then we had ourselves who were looking to provide as sustainable building as possible in order to continue banging the drum, in order to continue doing good for the earth through the construction industry. We found that the best way to do this presentation, and it was received well, was to go through and prove the concept first, to show that we were meeting daylight requirements, to show that we were environmentally comfortable with inside, and then to come in with the big hitters, which was the operational cost savings and the capital cost savings compared to a more typical budget design that you might look to do on one of these buildings. And I think that enabled us to get a real buy-in from everyone involved, all the stakeholders on the project, especially providing kind of payback periods, returns on investment. Immediately, the more financial driven people within that meeting, and you could see their eyes like lighting up as they realized we weren't just trying to create a difficult concept for our own egos. We were actually looking to save them money as well as save the impact of carbon on this planet.
Yeah. We tried to address every aspect of it. The environment is a very complex subject. Anything to do with the natural environment, it just isn't simple. There are lots of simple questions, no real simple answers. And I mean, we looked at everything that we thought could be counted as an offset in terms of operational costs. We actually as well started to take into account maintenance. Original concept called for plant gas boilers to be put on the roof or even air source heat pumps. And we looked at what the maintenance requirements would be for putting plant like that up on a roof, and we looked at how much it would cost for a crane to come, you know, at midpoint to swap things around. And that was just to demonstrate that a passive option would be far more cost effective than an active option, which is what we wanted to do. I think, Alex, you looked at a payback assessment as well, looking at what would happen if we introduced photovoltaics, didn't you?
We did, yeah. And it thankfully aligned with other studies done by the end occupier on a similar project. So
yeah,
I think with the cost of electricity in the UK at the moment, if you can maximise your roof with photovoltaic panels, financially it just makes sense. You're looking at 5 to 7 years of payback on your investment.
Yeah, and the client as well had opportunity to get grant-funded PVs. It tied in perfectly with our proposals, which were using ground source heat pumps for heating, as well as the passive ventilation and cooling. The PVs could be generating energy to feed into our system. And this report was incredibly well received. It went way better than I could have ever expected. And I think the difference was we were pushing an open door in terms, well, as soon as we started to talk about operational costs rather than capital expenditure, that's when we got the client, because it was going to be his building. And in fact, it worked almost too well. We enthused the client so much, they then asked us to look at extending the principles to the entire building. Almost from the outset, Alex and I knew this would be nearly impossible, just because the way it had been designed, the brief originally, it hadn't really been taken into account. And in the end, that did prove to be the case. But again, that was an interesting exercise, which in effect demonstrated that if these principles aren't taken into account from inception, it becomes very difficult to introduce. I think in the end, Alex demonstrated in his report that we could give the client a predicted operational saving, a saving in operational costs of around about £25,000 a year when compared to the base level.
Which was massively important for the client, yeah, because they'd had a whole host of projects that had recently PC'd and been in operation for a year where they were running miles over on their costs, and it was turning the whole financial model into just not what was expected.
And for me, it demonstrated and proved the concept of the integrated design team and us working off each other. And all too often, as professionals, if you're listening to this, you'll be aware that buildings really start off with a minimum number of people there, and engineers get appointed later on. That can't happen. It can't happen with sustainable design. Sustainability is a holistic process, needs to be integrated into buildings from the early stage, and that depends on an integrated design team for the earliest stages. So in conclusion, the success of the proposals that we arrived at illustrates just how effective that was. But also, it's really important to consider the fabric of the building and as an essential part of the environmental strategy, and exploring that right from inception as a constraint is a key part of a low energy solution. And as technologists, I firmly believe that should be what we are doing. We should be involved from the earliest stages and bringing our skills to the table to advise on how the envelope and the fabric of buildings can be exploited to provide a low-impact building. However, Holbeck's still not built. There are various funding problems with it.
There's only so much we can do, Chris.
Yeah, it's a complex contractual situation with a whole variety of clients involving local authorities. So the project is still live. Whether it'll end up like we hoped it would be, I don't know. But on paper, we know it works. It was a great experience, and Alex and I working together, I think it really opened both our eyes, didn't it?
Definitely. I think it was the first time I've had someone on my side within the design team with enough gusto, but also enough power in the design team to find that the work I was doing and the data that I was outputting from my models could actually make a difference. It was great.
Yeah, I am pushy, yeah. Alex is now with a company called Nullacarbo.
Correct.
Nullacarbo. So just want to let listeners know what you're doing at the moment, Alex.
Yeah, Nullacarbo, we're based in Leeds, very small specialist building performance consultancy. We've got decades of experience across the team, primarily looking at designing healthier internal environments through passive low energy strategies, looking at real world performance as well as just energy compliance. And I think the main thing I want to talk about that we've been doing is something called parametric analysis. So the story that Chris and I just told was looking at a serial analysis. It was looking at changing one variable at a time. So I said at the start about how we're going to go for daylight first, because if you get daylight, everything else is right. And that's great. And it's a very simple, typical way of going through this design process. We'll consider the daylight first. We'll make sure that it's as optimal as possible. And then we'll move on to the natural ventilation and thermal comfort strategies. Now, that allows a really good story to be told. But a new style of analysis called parametric allows us to analyze all of the variables that we just mentioned in parallel. So essentially, we could have put all of those different options, whether it's daylight, whether it's active systems, whether it's thermal mass, into a large model simulation and output, leveraging the kind of the power of computers that we have these days, to give us a kind of field of probability that would have enabled Chris and I to essentially pick out the perfect path for the building. Imagine you've got a box building, you're a technologist at stage one or two, you want to optimize the orientation of the building. So you do one variable change each time, you work out it probably wants to be westward facing, and then you go, what fabric U values should we go for? And you work out the optimal fabric U values for a west facing building. Now, what you may have missed is that there actually might be a more optimal solution for your ideal outcome using a different orientation, but you never explored it because you initially decided that north was the best orientation. Using the parametric analysis tool enables you to do it completely holistically and pick out the best possible design approach. But what's great is you can run thousands of simulations, all the different combinations of variables, and then sit down with the design team and restrict certain variables. So you might have someone chipping in from the planning side and say, look, we have to have the building facing this way. So you go, we're only going to look at simulations with a west-facing building. And then someone at the construction of the facade engineer may say, oh, we can't do a U-value that's any better than that. We can't put more insulation in. So you set another variable. And then suddenly you find that there's only three different options left, for example, that enables you to hit net zero carbon with a certain amount of rooftop PB. So this parametric analysis is so exciting for the future. And I'm hoping that Chris and I can work on another project again together.
It has
similar
moved
to Holbeck.
It has moved incredibly quick. The process we told you about is a couple of years ago now, isn't it? And the software has improved vastly. But the key to this is that the concepts that I was introducing to Alex weren't complex. What he needs is just somebody that understands what those concepts are, and then to get somebody like Alex involved to prove them and refine them. And that's the way forward for me, and that's what we should be introducing. I think that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to give Alex a huge thank you for joining us and sharing insights and what we did with the Holbeck project. And to everybody else out there, thanks for joining us. I hope you learned something from this, and I hope we made a difference. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Where It's At. A huge thanks to our guests and to you for listening. Want to learn more about architectural technology, how to progress your career, or how to work with a chartered architectural technologist? Head to architecturaltechnology.com to find out more. The contents and views expressed by individuals in the Where It's At podcast are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of the companies they work for or the host. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as advice.